This is a talk from BeThinking.org, which is UCCF's apologetic website. Apologetics is basically two things. It's the communication and the defence of the Christian gospel. So visit BeThinking.org soon, and make sure you sign up as a BeThinker to hear all about BeThinking.org's latest releases. I feel light
in your arms. My name is Jerry Root. I teach at Meaton College. I'm not an artist. I'm an appreciator of art, but most of my academic work is on C.S. Lewis, and so I was asked by Great if I would come and speak about Lewis and the arts. And Lewis wasn't an artist either. You might consider him an artist, a literary artist. He was a brilliant writer, and he could paint such great pictures with words. If you've read his fiction, you know what I'm talking about. But I think Lewis can help us in thinking about art and to make objective judgments about beauty. Beauty is not merely in the eye of the beholder. It may be, but not merely so. You can make statements about beauty that are objectively true. And how would that be possible? So there are misjudgments about beauty in art. The scoliosis of our misjudgments can be measured by the plumb line of objectivity. And how do we get to that? Especially when we think that a lot of art is itself that which moves us subjectively. So how do we keep respect for the subjectivity of our appreciation of art, and at the same time be able to make objective statements? Are there things that we could say about art that would be universally true, even though some may miss it, even though we may miss some things about it? And then I want to begin. What I'm going to do principally is an analysis of The Abolition of Man by C.S. Lewis. It's a very significant work of his many books. He felt this, Perlandra, and Till We Have Faces, where it's three best books. And this book was also included in The Great Books of the Western World by Mortimer Adler in 1968, i.e. included with Augustine, Plato, Aristotle, Thomas Aquinas, Dante, Milton, and so on. So an analysis, I think, will help guide us, and then I would like to go from Lewis's thoughts here and make application to beauty with a little help from Thomas Aquinas, if that's okay. And as I begin, I would like to say something like this. There's a passage in the Scriptures. It reads, "Suffer the little children to come unto me, for such is the kingdom of heaven." And that's a passage that intrigues me. And every time I go to it, I seem to discover something new in the text. Not something that's new by virtue of contradiction with what I've discovered before, but something that takes me a little bit deeper in that text. I suppose we could interpret it and say, children are trusting. I think we could look at it and we could say, children are relatively innocent. We're fallen. We don't say perfectly innocent, but relatively innocent in the sense that they're not jaded by life's experience and hardened and callous. And it's good for us to cultivate a kind of lifestyle that keeps us from becoming callous. Also, children are curious, naturally curious, I think. I had a father of one of my students come to me about 5 or 6 years ago and say, "Jerry, how's your soul?" I like that question because it takes you to some depths fairly quickly. And I had to do a quick analysis, and I looked at the man and I said, "You know, I don't think I've ever had more questions about my faith than I have right now." And he had this horrified look on his face as if to suggest he hoped his son would never get in any more of my classes. And as I saw the look on his face and realized it was a result of what I had said, I felt the rhetorical burden on me to try to clarify. And I said, let me say to you, I have never felt more loved by God than I feel right now. And I've never felt more in love with God than I feel right now. I feel like a child in a perfect, safe relationship who could ask any question he wants and knows he won't be trashed for asking the questions and having the questions. Knows that good answers will be forthcoming because those particular questions were asked. And also knows, in the days of ambiguity, when questions, answers aren't given, He trusts the one who has the answers until he deems it proper to give them. What's happened to our culture that to feel loved by God and to have questions seem to be incompatibles? It's interesting. Well, particularly in an area where often we meet ambiguity in the arts, to have questions seems to be, in some people's minds, inappropriate. If you don't see it like I see it, if I don't see it like you see it, whatever in debates or age. And then another thing, too, about that passage, suffer the children to come to me for such as a king. Children are awkward. You know, a toddler learning how to walk falls down and gets bruised. A child who finally takes the training wheels off the two-wheeler bike falls down and gets abrasions. An adolescent picking up a skateboard, trying to ollie or do the half pipe, might end up breaking a wrist or an ankle. Children are awkward. As a matter of fact, none of us is very life skilled. I don't think anybody's ever ready to get married. If we waited till we were, nobody would ever marry. Nobody's ever ready to have children. If we waited till we were, the whole human race would end this generation. Whatever your career is, nobody's ever ready. You don't have it fully accomplished when you enter into the career. All of us, at some level, are awkward. As a matter of fact, I'd suggest to you, if you're not awkward at some place in your life, you're just not growing. It's a necessary part of that. Okay, in light of that, we recognize then that there's the accommodation of life to the world in which we live, and the accommodation of thought to the world in which we live, the accommodation of aesthetic appreciation and enjoyment to the world in which we live. I want to move in those directions now with those preliminary remarks as we consider Lewis's argument in this book. There's a background for writing the book. There had been a book that had come out. Lewis calls it the Green Book throughout. He doesn't refer to it by its real name, but in fact it was The Control of Language by Alec King and Martin Ketley. And it was a book on how to teach grammar to children in fifth form in England, which would be about, I don't know, 15, 16-year-olds, that fair, Jody. And Lewis, a man who taught literary criticism, who taught medieval and Renaissance literature, would often get books to review. And when he reads this book, he's horrified at the kinds of things that are being inculcated into the minds of young men and women philosophically by virtue of this book. So he takes it to task. It was a grammar book with philosophical assumptions that Lewis would classify as subjectivism. I'll talk more about subjectivism in a bit, except suffice it to say right now, subjectivism is when the subject, the self, asserts itself in its judgments on the world without any respect for the objective reality that exists independent of one's thinking. There's a poem by Robert Browning called Rabbi Ben Ezra. All of you should get it, and as you age, if you're married, you should read it with your spouse. It starts off, "Grow old along with me, the best is yet to be." My wife and I read this to each other once in a while. A couple Christmases ago, she gave me the first lines on a plaque. It's on the wall next to my bed at home. About line 20 of that poem, he says, "Welcome each rebuff that turns her smoothness rough." We think we've got it all figured out. We've got the earth nice and smooth. But the earth isn't smooth. It has texture. It has geography. It has peaks. It has valleys. Welcome the difficult things that might occur to help you see things as they are rather than how you would have them be. Because if you're stuck in the realm of how you would have to have things be, you're a subjectivist. And the scoliosis of your thought, maybe even the scoliosis of your soul, has no hope of being straightened because you are denying the plumb line of reality that exists independent of your thinking about it. Okay? So Lewis takes on this book, and he sets forth, it's written anyway, the Abolition of Man is written, with basically a traditional approach to thought. The traditional approach to thought would be this. There are objects that exist independent of our thinking about them, i.e. there are things to be known. Second, there are subjects, there are knowers. with the capacity to know and understand. Truth is approximated when what one thinks or knows corresponds with reality. Reality is not truth. Truth is what I think about reality when I think accurately about it. There are corollaries, too. One corollary is that there are no last words. We don't get a last word about anything. I tell that to my students sometimes, and they slip into existential despair because they think I'm a relativist at that moment. And I say, oh, no, I'm not a relativist at all. There are no last words, but that does not mean there are no sure words. There are sure words. There are things that can be known and that we know, but even the truths I know can be plumbed more deeply, applied more widely, and seen in coherent relations with other truths. How many of you have read through the Bible, and in reading through the next time, you came to a passage and it spoke to you profoundly, and you said, where was that the last time I looked through the scriptures? Or maybe you came to another text like the one we just looked at, suffer the little children to come unto me. I don't think I'm ever going to get to the bottom of that text, but I keep going back to it and discovering more things in it. Okay? So we don't get a last word, but that doesn't mean we can't get a sure word. And any truth I might know can be plumbed deeper, it can be applied wider, and it can be seen in coherent relations with other truths. This is due to the complexity of reality, and also it's due to the complexities of human limitation. Another thing that Lewis says that I think is in part implicit in the ideas of this book, and I would suggest to you, this is the dominant idea in all of C.S. Lewis's books. It appears even in his pre-Christian writing. And I think it's why he was constantly opening up to a bigger and more complex world, constantly able to describe in fresh ways what he was noticing about reality. And this is the concept, reality is iconoclastic. I think I mentioned it yesterday. Were any of you in the forum yesterday? The apologetic forum? Okay, good. It's all fresh for you. Reality is iconoclastic. An iconoclast is a person who breaks idols. So I have an idea of God. I come to an art seminar. I hear Ali in the next hour. He says something, and all of a sudden pieces of the puzzle go together for me a little bit better. And the present image of God, it's profound. I'm so refreshed by it. But if I hold on to that present image of God too tightly, then it competes against my having a growing understanding of God. And the image, once helpful, now becomes an idol, you see. And Lewis would write that God is constantly kicking out the walls of any temples I build for him because God wants to give me more of himself. The way he puts it in his autobiography, Surprised by Joy, God cares nothing about temples built. Only about temples built. Matter of fact, in some ways, the whole artistic endeavor is to try to get the viewers of our art or the readers of our literature to see reality from a fresh angle, isn't it? You're a photographer, Jody. You take a picture because you saw something, and you help us now as observers of your art to see what you have seen and we might have missed it. Reality is iconoclastic. It's an old idea. Augustine said, the house of my soul is too small. Enlarge it, O Lord, that you might enter in. Stephen, before Augustine, in Acts chapter 7, his defense, he's on trial for speaking against the temple. And he says to the religious leaders in Jerusalem, you think you've got God contained in the box of this temple? It's not true. God's bigger than this temple. As a matter of fact, when God first spoke to Abraham, our father, it was in Mesopotamia, hundreds of miles from where this temple is. When God spoke to Moses, it was from a burning bush in the Midian wilderness, hundreds of miles from where this temple is. And even when David wanted to build this temple, God said, heaven is my throne, earth is my footstool. How will you build a house that contains me? And the artist, really, in many ways, operates best when the artist believes there's something to be known. And if we look at reality well, we know that there's something of God revealed in it. Creation is the garment of God. That's how Calvin called it. So consequently, if you show us a fresh angle, and you show us something of creation well, hopefully reality is iconoclastic for us. We're seeing in a fresh way, in a new way, an imaginative way, filtered through the gifts that God's given you, the uniqueness of your personality, the uniqueness of your skills and gifts and so on. Okay? The reality is iconoclastic. Subjectivism, however, occurs when the subject no longer takes its cues from objective reality and begins to project onto reality, as we've already mentioned. This may begin innocently enough. A child wrestling with his parents' divorce at a tender time in his emotional development might come to the place where he or she ends up in a high-performance treadmill. If I would have just done more, maybe Dad would have stayed. Another child says, Dad left, therefore what? I must be dirt. I must be no value at all. He gets in a self-destruct pattern. Another child says, I don't want to ever hurt like this again. And they end up in a high-control way. They don't want to give up control because they feel if they're on top of the game, nobody can get through to hurt them so much. And so on. And consequently, I can become self-referential at that point, interpreting reality in an incorrect way and responding in an incorrect way, and it's subjectivistic. Wordsworth said the child is the father of the man. He could have said the child is the mother of the woman. But sometimes the impressions of childhood last so long in us and run so deep in us and velcro to us particular experiences that cause us to see life only that way. It's hard to let go, you see. All elephants walk in a single file line, at least the one I saw did. And we universalize our own experience and overgeneralize, and we get stuck in a rut. It's maintenance. Subjectivism's maintenance can lead to unsavory consequences. Baron von Hugel, the philosopher of religion, said, beware of the first clarity. Press on to the second clarity or the third clarity. An artist helps us do that, hopefully. They're helping us to see things in fresh light, helping us to press on to further clarities. Lewis said, I want God, not my idea of God. I want my neighbor, not my idea of my neighbor. I want myself, not my idea of myself. All of Lewis's evil characters in his literature, all of them in his fiction, maintain their choices through the rationalizations of subjectivism. How many of you read all the Narnian Chronicles? Okay? You know the magician's nephew. And we meet the white witch. She's Queen Jadis of Charm, right? And what does she do? Her whole kingdom has mounted up against her. She has learned the deplorable word, which gives her the power to destroy everybody else but save herself. And she speaks the deplorable word. In that sense, she becomes anti-Aslan, or anti-Christ, because she destroys her world to save herself, rather than like Aslan, who gives himself to save his world. She's a subjectivist. Reality is of no consequence. She is projecting herself on her world. The ghosts in The Great Divorce would be like this. They're self-referential. Weston becomes the young man. Very self-referential and so on. Lewis writes an essay called The Poison of Subjectivism. And he shows that this subjectivism can destroy a culture. He writes in this particular essay, one cause of misery and vice is always present with us in the greed and pride of men. But at certain periods in history, this is greatly increased by the temporary prevalence of some false philosophy. Correct thinking will not make good men of bad ones, but a purely theoretical error may remove ordinary checks to evil and deprive good intentions from their natural support. An error of this sort is abroad at present. And I am referring to subjectivism. Lewis sees it as a dominant evil. And the other thing, too, that's interesting to me is people's approach to art can become subjectivistic, self-referential. And you artists are plagued by this kind of thing, I think. And you need to be able to take a stand if you're going to take a Christian approach to art, to be a person who sees the interplay between the subject taking its lead from the object itself. Okay? And we'll talk more about that as we go on. It was a result of this essay, The Poison of Subjectivism. It was a result of him getting this book that he had to do literary critical work of, that he wrote the book, The Abolition of Man. He delivered these initially as the Rydell Memorial Lectures. In letters to an American lady, he wrote, it is almost my favorite among my books. So now, let's go on with the outline of the book. There's three chapters in the book, and then there are a collection of quotes at the end of the book where he gives examples of what he calls objective value, examples of objective value in the literature of the world, both Occidental, Western, and Oriental, Eastern literature. The first chapter is called Men Without Chess. And Lewis tells a story at the beginning of that book that he takes from Dorothy Wordsworth, William Wordsworth's sister's Grasmere journal. And she tells a time when she and William Wordsworth were on a vacation, a holiday, on the River Clyde, and they were with Coleridge. Here's Coleridge here, little people with a beard and a top hat. Okay, the romantic poet. And the Coleridge had been on a walk, and he came to this waterfall on the River Clyde, and there were two tourists there. And the two tourists were looking at the waterfall. Now what we have here is an object, the waterfall, and the subject, the tourists who happen to be looking at it, Coleridge who happens to be looking at it. Object and subject. The way truth should work is that the subjective understanding should correspond with the objective reality. And that Coleridge had commented that the two tourists looking at the waterfall, one said it was pretty, and the other one said it was sublime. And Coleridge endorsed mentally that the one who said it was sublime spoke accurately. Now, they're not one of them's not looking at it and said, this is really ugly, and the other one's saying this is really beautiful. They're both seeing it in a positive way. But one's description is far less and far less reflective of the robustness of what this waterfall is. The one who says it's sublime says, do you have a platonic ideal of what a beautiful waterfall should look like? This is about as close to an approximation as I've ever seen. This is a sublime waterfall. The writers of the Green Book reveal this story, and then they say, Coleridge had no right to make that judgment, to make a value judgment about these two statements. Because, the writers of the Green Book say, these two were not saying anything about the waterfall. They were only saying something about their own feelings. And at that moment, the writers of the Green Book make a separation between the object and the subject. Now, do you see a problem with the judgment of the writers of the Green Book at this point? What is it?
They're saying something objectively true about Coleridge's affirmation.
Beg your pardon?
They're saying something objectively true about Coleridge.
The writers of the Green Book. Well, it's not objectively true, is it? Because it's inconsistent. But they're making a judgment about him. Do you see what they're saying? He can't make a judgment about what they say, but they see no problem with making a judgment about what he says. What's the value for that? It's so arbitrary, and by virtue of its arbitrary, because they apply it onto Coleridge, it's also tyrannical and self-referential. Very dangerous. The only way I can make a judgment that this judgment is right or wrong is if I have some plumb line, some objective standard by which I can measure it. Lewis, when he reads this, and Gaius and Titius says, there's all kinds of philosophy that's being smuggled into students' minds, and it's bad. And so he seeks to correct this. He says there's a thing called the doctrine of objective value. And he calls this, by virtue of shorthand, the Tao. You could say Tao if you choose. T-A-O. How many of you have read The Abolition of Man? Okay, got a few of you. And the doctrine of objective value is simply this, that certain things are true and others really false to the kind of thing we are and the kind of thing the universe is. That's how he defines it. He quotes other people to show examples of this. Thomas Traherne, the metaphysical poet, says, can we be just if we don't render to things their due? So somehow there's a justice in art because we seek to render to a thing its due. We don't make a complete statement about reality in our art, but we try to make a true statement. And if I don't see well and make a correct judgment about a work of art, I haven't rendered to that work of art its due. I'm unjust. Augustine talked about ordo amoris, ordered love, ordered affection. It's interesting that when Lewis is writing this, they're expressing their feelings about this. And Lewis is saying they're not only making objective judgments about this, the subject is responding to the object, they're not only making objective judgments about this, even their emotions can be judged to be true or false, or good or bad, or just or unjust, or ordinate or inordinate. based on how they respond. You go to a birthday party and you're morose, something's not right. If you go to a funeral and you're giddy, something's not right. Now, maybe on your way to the birthday party, you got a phone call on your cell phone and you were told your best friend was killed in an automobile accident. Well, there would be a just reason for you feeling the way you do at the birthday party. But there's an objective reason why we have these responses. Ordo amoris is what Augustine called it. And consequently, Lewis says what we end up with is men without chests. They think their heads are really big, but they have denied true sentiment, true emotional feeling. And consequently, what follows in the wake of that is the loss, too, of good thinking. In this, he says, at the end of this, he says, they have no hearts, let alone heads, to correspond to reality. We make men without chests and expect of them virtue and enterprise. We laugh at honor and are shocked to find traitors in our midst. We castrate and bid the geldings be fruitful. Thieves expect honor among them. Adulterers expect fidelity. Traitors want friends. Who wants to be a friend of a traitor? Who wants to be a friend of a gossip? Why is it that we have this incongruity? Okay, then the next chapter is called The Way. And Lewis goes on to say, if the authors of the Green Book debunk traditional value, yet write books seeking to persuade people to their point of view, they must still believe some point of view is worthy. So what are they using as an artificial Tao? You see? And they develop arbitrary substitutes for the Tao or objective value, and Lewis examines three of these. One is instinct, that could be a substitute value. Another one is utilitarianism, and another one is economic value, and Lewis analyzes each one to show its bankruptcy because it's not robust enough to explain the world the way that it is, okay? Or to account for the world it is. For Lewis, the Tao cannot be proved. It is axiomatic. And he says, if nothing is self-evident, nothing can be proved. Similarly, if nothing is obligatory for its own sake, nothing is obligatory at all. In the final chapter, Lewis writes, if morality is arbitrary, man's power over nature will end up as the power of some men over others. It will end in a tyranny. You can have artistic tyranny, I think, too. When all that says it is good has been debunked, what says I want remains. There's a self-referential side. It's subjectivistic or subjectivism. And Lewis concludes the book by basically saying, either we are rational spirit obliged forever to obey the absolute values of the Tao, or else we are mere nature to be kneaded and cut into new shapes for the pleasures of masters who must, by hypothesis, have no motive but their own natural impulses. Only the Tao provides a common human law of action which can overarch rulers and ruled alike. A dogmatic belief in objective value is necessary for the very idea of a rule, which is not tyranny, or an obedience, which is not slavery. Didn't I put that in your notes? That quote? Okay. So let's look at some applications of the doctrine of objective value. I think we have to have truth within a dialectical community, and a dialectically safe community. I want to get to an object. The better I can get to the object, I can't depend upon my own perspective on that. My perspective is valuable. It's useful. It's beneficial. But it's incomplete. How many of you have ever read the poem, The Six Blind Men and the Elephant? Do you know this poem? Any of you not heard of it before? It's by John Godfrey Sachs. And it's these six blind men who come upon an elephant. And they've been friends. One grabs the leg of the elephant and says an elephant's like a tree trunk. Another one bumps up against the side of the elephant, and he says the elephant is like a wool. Another one grabs hold of the tail, and he says, no, 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 an elephant's like a rope. Another one has hold of the tusk. He says, no, it's like a spear. Another one has hold of the nose and says, no, it's like a giant snake. Another one has hold of the ear, and he says, no, it's like a giant leaf. Now, each of them are partially right, but none of them really knows what an elephant is. And if each one doubts, I have this experience, my experience is valid, I know it firsthand, I don't believe you're accurate. But if they would listen, if the guy holding onto the leg would grab hold of the guy with the side of the elephant and take him to feel the leg, and then the other guy feel the side, and all of a sudden they share in this experience, wow, their perspective of elephant grows. It's not complete still, but it's better than the ones who are just looking at one aspect. We want dialectically safe community. The artist speaks in the dialectically safe community, hopefully. so we can see better, see further, imagine what we haven't imagined. Lewis said at the end of the experiment criticism, my own eyes are not enough for me. I would see what others have seen and read what they have written. Even what they've written and seen is not enough for me. I would read what they've imagined. Even that's not enough for me. I regret that the brutes cannot write books. Gladly would I see how the world presents itself to the eye of a mouse or a bee, or how it comes charged to the olfactory sense of a dog. Isn't that cool? Okay, so I want truth in a dialectical community. This requires a degree of security. The scriptures say perfect love casts out fear. I have this feeling that Lewis, if you've read Mere Christianity, he says pride is a great sin. Augustine said the same thing. I think they're wrong. Is that terrible? I don't know if I can. They're big, I'm little. I'm making this judgment about them. I don't know if it's fair, but if you think about pride for a second, think about the Pharisees. Why were the Pharisees so proud and pharisaical? Why did they project an image of themselves and the culture? I don't have to, huh?
Because they were scared.
I think it's fear. I don't have to go back to the Pharisees to find out. I can say, well, when I get pretentious, what's going on inside of me? And I want you to see me one way, because I think if you see me how I really am, you won't like me. And it's fear that drives it. And consequently, we can become arrogant in community. We can maybe say, well, I think the elephant really is a leg. And somebody says, no, it's not. And then I get huffy and defensive about what I see and experience. I'm afraid. And the scriptures say perfect love casts out fear. Imperfect love creates anxiety. But perfect love casts out fear. And so I think the antecedent to pride is fear. And the antecedent to fear is not knowing that we're loved. So we're afraid to talk about this. Anyway, let's move on and just say that emotions can be in harmony with reason also. Again, there's Augustine's Ordo Amoris, Traherne's Can We Be Just, Lest We Render to Things Their Due Esteem. Well, let's see if we can move these ideas now from the realm. Any questions about this so far? From the realm of truth, objectivity, subjectivism, self-referentialism, and so on. Yes, Jody.
Your wonderful quote is then, when was it from?
Beg your pardon?
The wonderful quote.
Which wonderful quote? Experiment and Criticism, in the epilogue, it's in the last two pages of the book. By the way, in that book, in the epilogue too, Lewis says, it's on page 138, in coming to understand anything, we must reject the facts as they are for us in favor of the facts as they are. It's a statement similar to the argument that he's building. You want it? If you want it right now. In coming to understand anything, we must reject the facts as they are for us in favor of the facts as they are. In coming to understand anything, we must reject the facts as they are for us in favor of the facts as they are. Okay. But now,
Excuse me, ask a question. Isn't that true in understanding people, even though they may not be the facts?
Oh, yeah.
They're the facts for them.
Yes.
We have to reject our facts to understand them.
Absolutely.
He's talking here about the facts, period.
Any objective reality. I must reject what I think is for what is. Mm-hmm. And that doesn't mean that I can't be appreciative of what I know in the moment. Mm-hmm. But I said this yesterday in this one forum, and I think there was a little bit of a reaction to it at first, but I think I was able to make my point. All worldviews, even a Christian worldview, must be open to modification. And church history teaches us that. Our worldview today is informed by Nicaea, by Chalcedon, by the Reformation. Even a Christian worldview, because the God we're trying to explain is bigger than any present understanding. Lewis writes a book called The Discarded Image. And he develops an understanding. He says, if you read a medieval book, you better understand medieval backgrounds, lest you read 21st century values, there's subjectivism, into the medieval book. Try to understand as best you can. You'll never get it completely. We're not living in the atmosphere of the Middle Ages when we read the book, but maybe we can make some noble approximation. He says, if you think you need notes when you read Milton, imagine the notes Milton would read if he were to read a modern book. What's a DVD? What's a telephone? What's a microwave? What's an automobile? What's an airplane? All the footnotes. It would be just a little bit of text and tons of footnotes, you see. Well, why do we think that we, reading a book in that tongue, have it all figured out? Just because we're a little further along. Again, this is self-referential. Lewis talks about the chronological snobbery, that we in our age look back at people before and we think we're so much better than them. And so we read the past and we try to understand it. And all academic enterprise is to see pattern and exception. Pattern makes a generalization so that I can pass on a body of knowledge to somebody else. But if I don't count for the exception, I have made my generalization a universal truth. It's not. So I look at the past and I generalize. I cut history into segments. This is the Middle Ages. This is classical times. This is pre-classical times. This is the Renaissance. This is the Enlightenment. This is modernity. This is post-modernity. You see? Okay, we finally got it all figured out. It's the arrogance of an evolutionary worldview, I think. Lewis says, "Do you really think there was anybody running around in the Middle Ages saying, 'I live in the Middle Ages'?" And he says in his essay on historicism, which is another look at subjectivism, he says in historicism that we don't know where we are in the spectrum of history. We don't know if the ills of our culture are the ills of infancy or the ills of senility. We can make some statements about our time, that there's interesting characters, there's tragic events. But to make a grand scheme of history, we don't know exactly where we are in the spectrum. So if we project too much, we're in trouble. And he says also there's nothing in history, in the history of thought, like a shoreline in geography. Now I'm in the ocean, now I'm on dry land. Now I'm in the Middle Ages, now I'm in the Enlightenment. This doesn't exist. You have to be careful with these judgments. The classifications are okay as long as I hold the classifications gently. You see? Okay? So now let's move on to beauty, though. Oh, any other, is that helpful? Is that any other? It was way more than you wanted. No, I have a tendency to give more than people want. You know, I have a 48-hour tour of Oxford. My wife says, "Jerry, people only want a 2-hour tour of Oxford." I say, "I can't give a 2-hour. There's just too much here." And then whenever she says people only want a 2-hour tour of Oxford, I always cite G.K. Chesterton's essay in praise of bores. He says the good thing about bores is that they're interested in something. You know, so everybody's... All right, well, let's see if we can make an application now to beauty. Because if I make a judgment of beauty, is beauty merely in the eyes of the beholder? Is it merely subjective? Or can I speak objectively about beauty with respect for the way I might feel about it? Because the feeling's about an object of art, or an object of nature that maybe somebody's trying to capture or express in their art. Because art is communication. Matter of fact, I would say to you, art is a kind of rhetoric. And if it's rhetoric, it's persuasive. And if it's persuasive, it's either manipulative or it's ethical. Oh, as a matter of fact, let me take a moment here about this. Richard Weaver, he wrote the book Ideas Have Consequences. He also wrote a book called The Ethics of Rhetoric. All artists should know this, right? He says there are kinds of ethical arguments. The first kind of ethical argument, I think I put this in your notes, didn't I? Okay, and I almost passed it over. Please forgive me. The first kind of ethical argument is the argument from definition. Definition. If I define a thing, and if I define it well, I now have an object to appeal to when I make judgments of it. It's the best and most ethical kind of argument. But what do I do here? Because the word definition means de finis of the finite. We define a thing by its limitation and its function. I can define anything that I can wrap words around, i.e. I can distinguish this thing from another thing. This is a marking pen. True. I can talk about it now once I've defined it. If I say it's a marking pen, is that all there is to say about it? No, it has a length, a width. It has a volume of ink. It has a particular, if Aristotle was here, he'd say it has a formal cause, a pattern after it was made, a material cause. It has an efficient cause, somebody who made it. It has a final cause, et cetera, et cetera. Okay, I can distinguish it from the pad. I can distinguish it from the writing on the pad. All these are things small enough to wrap words around them. I could define them. How do you define God? He's infinite, isn't he? So he defies the category. So consequently, how would I speak about God in an ethical way? Well, the second form of argument is the argument from similitude. Similitude. Jesus says the kingdom of heaven is like. And he goes into figurative language to describe these things. Lewis sometimes uses fiction for apologetics. An artist can use art for apologetics because there are some things that couldn't be said better any other way. He said in a preface to Paradise Lost, we often forget when a man writes a love sonnet, he not only loves the woman, he loves the sonnet. Lewis writes fiction and he says sometimes fiction is the best way to say what needs to be said. Or story is the best, fairy story is the best way to say what needs to be said. So there's the use of similitude in making argument. The third one is consequence. And Weaver believes this is the least ethical. Because I'm appealing to something that doesn't exist. If you vote for my opponent in this election, the whole country is going to go to hell in a handbasket. How do I know what's going to happen? I don't know that for sure. And so I'm trying to persuade you to do what I want you to do, and I'm appealing to no objective reality. It's pure subjectivism and manipulative. Okay? And then the fourth one is the argument from authority. And Weaver doesn't give this any classification at all. He says this is really the kind of argument that people do that can't think. So they quote somebody else and they produce books called The Quotable Lewis and stuff like that. It's just goofy as all get out. Okay. But now, let's see if we can apply this to Weaver. What are we doing here? How are we doing time-wise?
We're okay.
All right? Oh, you've got it there. Where do we go to?
There's 11:30.
Oh, really? Okay, good, good, good. All right. And here I'm going to borrow now. I'm going to shift gears a little bit, and I'm going to borrow two from Thomas Aquinas from the Summa Theologica, because he'll help us here, to take what Lewis is saying about how we know something, about the relationship of the subject, we as knowers, to the object, that which can be known. And we're going to apply it to beauty. And Aquinas says there's a thing called admirable beauty. Admirable beauty is that which is intrinsic in the object itself. Whether I see it or not, it's there. Okay? Then there is what he calls enjoyable beauty. And enjoyable beauty is subjective. Subjective isn't bad. Every time I come as a knower, I'm a subjective person. And I'm trying to bring into line with the objective reality my subjective understanding. That's okay. My feelings, my subjective feelings, I want to bring in line with the objective reality. That's okay. But here we've got then the object, like the waterfall, and enjoyable, like the people standing looking at the waterfall. Right? Intrinsic to the object and the subject. Now, let me say a couple things about this, too. One time I said to my wife, I thought Picasso was an idiot. She said, really? What do you know about Picasso? And I said, nothing. And she said, then we need to revise here who the idiot is. And she took me to the Chicago Art Institute because she had taken a course on Picasso and they were having a Picasso exhibit. And we walked through the exhibit and my eyes were open. I had a subjective understanding that wasn't connected to the object, you see. She, who knew about the object and also had a subjective understanding that was connected to the object, could take me and give her expert opinion so that my eyes could be open to this thing. I'll give you another example. How many of you have been to Prague? How many of you have been to St. Vitus up on the hill that dominates the city? How many of you have seen the third stained glass window on the left? I think I have a copy of it here in my Bible. Keep it dear and near to my heart. Oh, maybe I won't. Maybe I've taken it.
Ah!
That window. Do you remember it? You remember it? Pass it around. It was under communism. I was giving lectures in Eastern Europe. I got up to St. Vitus, and I saw that window, and I just sat there breathless for 20 minutes. I made the pilgrimage back to that window 5 times in my life, just because I had to see the window. The only time I was in Prague and didn't see it is when David said we had to eat dinner at 3 Violins, and we never got to it because Dave had an aesthetic experience with food and he wanted to go back to the food. We've got to understand these things. We have these different experiences. I remember one time walking in the New York, the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York, and we're walking along. And I see Van Gogh's Cypresses in a Wheat Field. This postcard does not do it justice. I'm walking along, and here it is. The amber waves of grain look like movement. You've seen it before when you've driven by a wheat field and there's wind blowing and it really looks like water. In the sky is as turbulent as if we're seeing reflected in the sky what the water of waves of grain are doing. And I'm looking at this painting and I'm so in awe, I just stand there for about 15 or 20 minutes. And then I come to the conscious realization that other people maybe want to see this painting. And so I think, oh yeah, I've got to back up. And so I back up, and all of a sudden I run into a bench. And I look, it's like a stone bench. And I sit down on that bench, and I just drink in this painting. And watch it for about another 15 or 20 minutes. Really grateful for the bench that somebody put there. You know how art museums, you have those rooms with all the paintings, and the doors going from one room to another are real wide? It dawned on me then, I was with people at the museum. What happened to them? So I'm looking down the 4 or 5 rooms that way, and the 4 or 5 rooms that way to see if I can see the people that I'm with. And when I'm looking down the rooms, you know what I notice? There's no other bench anyplace else in that museum along that hall, only in front of this painting. Why? Because I probably wasn't the only one who had that experience. There was something so marvelous about that painting that other people, when they saw it, even an untrained eye like mine, you had to fall under the spell of that. The objective, admirable. Okay? Now, expert opinion could help us see the things that we might not catch. I want to get back to that, but I want to say one more thing about this, because this becomes worship then, and a worship experience, really. In the last book that Lewis wrote before he died, I think it's his best book. I don't think it's his most complex. I don't think it's probably his most imaginative, but I think it's his best because it's his most elegant, talking about the doxology of life and worship. In chapter 17 of that book, I think it's the best thing he wrote, my opinion. There's a paragraph in that chapter. I'm going to recite it for you in just a moment. But there's a word that he uses, and the word, do I have this in your thing? The word is coruscation. Coruscation. Do I have it?
No.
Okay. Coruscation is a word. I'm going to define it for you. You probably know it. When I first read this, I had no clue what the word meant. So if you're like me, I'm not. Huh?
Which is the book?
It's the book, I'm sorry, I didn't tell you the title, did I?
Minor detail.
Yeah, forgive me. It's the book called Letters to Malcolm, Chiefly on Prayer. It's the last book he wrote before he died. It's a book full of devotion. Some people read The Grief Observed after his wife died. They think, wow, Lewis was in a pretty shabby state of faith when he died, wasn't he? I say, no, read the last book he prepared before he died. It's full of rich worship and devotion. The word is coruscation. And coruscation means a sudden flash of brightness. Okay? So you could talk about seeing dark clouds of a storm coming your way and watching the lightning coruscating in the clouds. Or where I live in the Midwest of the United States, we have lightning bugs or fireflies. And we could talk about the lightning bugs coruscating on a hot summer evening in the back garden. Okay? You with me? Here's the quote. Gratitude exclaims very properly, "How good of God to give me this." But adoration says, "What must that being be like, whose far off and momentary coruscations are like this?" one's mind runs back up the sunbeam to the sun. That moment in the museum, seeing that picture. The moment in that cathedral and seeing that window. Or have you been to Saint-Chapelle in Paris? That whole cathedral, the glorious windows, or the chapel at Exeter College in Oxford, which was modeled after Saint-Chapelle. Same sort of experience. Now here's the thing. When Lewis wrote that, what must God be like? We never get the full grasp. The artist helps us see further and imagine it in new ways that we've never considered before. So that we might say, wow, God's like that. I remember when I read that the first time, that paragraph, it was about 1979. Voyager, the interplanetary probe, is speeding past Saturn, most mysterious of all of our planets, right? It's the one with rings. And it took pictures and sent them back to Jet Propulsion Laboratory in Pasadena, California, where your son lives, right? You know?
That's right.
And they discovered that the outer ring of Saturn, the F ring, is braided. I thought to myself, wow, what must God be like? Though no human eye had ever seen it, he chose to braid the outer ring of Saturn. I've talked to physicists. I live in an academic world. I've talked to physicists. I said, why is it braided? I've heard about six different explanations. None of them standing the possibility of the other five explanations. We should take that one over to the science forum and see what they're doing. That's better than pins in a pocket. And I just said to myself, what must God be like that he braided the outer ring of Saturn? I shared this with one friend of mine. He said, yeah, Jerry, we don't know if he didn't just braid it for the picture. I think of ships that park themselves over depths of the ocean greater than the light of the sun can reach, and they'll dangle cameras on tethers and take pictures of fish painted neon bright. Why? Wow, thank you. What must God be like? You can think, I grew up in Southern California, I love to see palm trees silhouetted against an auburn sunset sky. Or a mountain range silhouetted against an auburn sunset sky. Or in the prairie Midwest of the United States, a cornfield silhouetted against an auburn sunset sky. You laugh about it, but there's beauty there to be found if we just look long enough. Something we might have missed at first makes its way into our consciousness. But we could have lived on a dark planet and been told that there would be one sunset, and we could have lined every west coast of every continent and every island on our planet. And as we saw the glory of that event and tears came to our eyes, we could have written about it in our journals and regaled our progeny with the glory of that event. But what must God be like that he has made our planet a perpetual kaleidoscope of sunrises and sunsets? Wow. One star twinkling in a night sky should be enough to make any right-thinking mind, an open heart, fall into a state of wonder. But God is so liberal with his glory that he's littered the heavens with stars and moons and suns, galaxies and shooting stars. I wish you could have been with me at Wheaton College's Northwoods campus up by Lake Superior. I was on a ski dock one night from midnight to 2:30 in the morning with a bunch of students. We watched the sky pulsating and coruscating with northern lights, reds and greens and blues and whites. And we had to just start singing hymns of praise because that was a right response to the objective reality. A subjective heart response brought itself in accord with the plumb line of God's glory as he was revealing it in nature. G.K. Chesterton said, one elephant with a trunk looked odd. Every elephant with a trunk looked like a plot. God's calling us to attend, and we forget. What higher role for a Christian artist? Not to try to be manipulative with your art. Not to try to be cheesy with your art. But if you just tell the story well with your art, we'll be drawn in and something of the glory of God will be revealed. Okay? So there's the admirable and the enjoyable. But what is the objective quality of the admirable whereby we can say, yep, that's beautiful. Yep, that makes sense. Otherwise, it's just subjective, isn't it? So here's what Thomas Aquinas says. Let me just read you what he wrote. It's in the Summa Theologica. It's in section 1, book 39, subsection 8. Summa Theologica 1, 39, 8. You can go read it yourself. It's a sort of cast-off line. He's talking about a theological issue, but he says this about beauty. Beauty includes three conditions: integrity or perfection, since those things which are impaired are by the very fact ugly; due proportion or harmony; and lastly, brightness or clarity, once things are called beautiful, which have an elegant color. So he's saying there's integrity, proportion, and clarity. These are characteristics intrinsic in the thing itself, whereby we would say these things are beautiful. All right? So let me give you some examples. Integrity. What countries are represented here? England? England?
Romania.
Romania? Where in Romania?
Cluj.
Cluj, Pace. Do you know Benny Ferraga? Yes. Nora? Tell them hello when you go back.
Romania.
Germany?
Romania.
Romania, which country?
Yash.
Yash? Uh-huh, where all the beautiful monasteries with the blue paintings and so on are?
Close by.
Close by?
Originally United States, 30 yeah. years ago.
United Even States, now where?
Europe.
Now where?
Hungary.
Hungary?
U.S.
And, but Bratislava?
Slovakia.
Slovakia?
Hungary.
Hungary, where?
Originally in Budapest, now in Vespa.
Uh-huh. And U.S. now, but England originally? Yeah?
U.S.
U.S., okay. How many of you in your countries buy Christmas trees? What do you buy? You go to the lot to buy a tree, or you go to the forest to cut one down? You buy one that looks like that? Or do you buy one that looks like... like that? Which one do you buy? You laugh. Why? Because it's so sensical. It's so right. And to think of it other than this makes you laugh because of its nonsensical nature. It's intrinsic in the thing itself. And a right-thinking mind would see that. Now, if a child didn't see it, you might have to say, let me show you why this is more beautiful. This has integrity with what we have an idea of treeness. Now, that could be a Platonic ideal, or if we're Aristotelian, it could be the accumulated experience of trees over a long period of time, and that feeds our understanding of what a tree is as we make the generalization from all the complex numbers of experiences. There's other ways you can look at it, but okay. You buy a pumpkin at Halloween for the cornucopia at Thanksgiving or something like that. You buy something that looks like that? Or you buy something that looks like that? We make the choice. Now, maybe you want something grotesque for Halloween. You want to make a jack-o'-lantern, so you buy this one. Maybe you could do that. Okay, integrity. Next one is proportion. Proportion. When I was a boy, I was in in first grade, and my teacher said, okay, we're going to do a book all about me. So the first thing I had to do is draw a picture of myself. Then I had to draw a picture of my family members. Then there was still time left in class, so the period wasn't over. I said to the teacher, what should I do? She said, draw something you like. So I drew an airplane. And I went up to her and said, teacher, I'm done. And she said, there's still time in class. There's still time. Draw something else. So I drew three airplanes. And I said, teacher, I'm done. I'm done. What should we do? She said, there's still time. Draw something else. So I looked at the clock. Okay, I'll draw the clock. Oops. What was the matter with that clock? You know, it might work on the refrigerator with the magnets for the parents, but that's not going to make it in an art museum. It lacks proportions. It doesn't do what clocks do. Unless maybe I wanted to put it in a surreal, you know, Salvador Dali maybe could do something with it. He could melt it or put it over the table or something. But, okay, here's another example. We don't just think of seeing proportion in a particular way. There could be creative ways of seeing proportion. Something different. Let's borrow Picasso, right? Because now all of a sudden, he's not my favorite artist, but he does things for us. So he draws this. What's that?
Counterpigeon.
Huh?
It's a beautiful buttock. I hope.
Well, the deal is, it's not bad in light of its proportion. But he just uses the margin here, and he brings our eyes in
to take up the whole of it. He comes up with a creative way, a fresh way of looking at it that maybe we haven't seen before. And it does something for us. How about clarity? I don't know if you've ever looked at snakes. My kids had they've had several snakes. Snakes have personalities. They had one really tender California king snake. When my kids would come home, they would take it out of the aquarium and wear it while they did their homework. My son Grady, who used to feed it, it had particular affection for Grady. When Grady would come home and it would hear his voice, he would raise up in the aquarium. If the other kids were worrying him, if Grady came home, he would raise up because he wanted to go to Grady. He really liked Grady. It was an affectionate snake. You just haven't been around them enough to know what they're like, their personalities. The California king snake has bands around it. It has a brown band, an amber band, a yellow, almost gold band. And then it repeats. It's beautiful. We've got a garter snake, too, which is great. The California king snake's more beautiful by virtue of its clarity, its color, its brightness. We had a red rat snake. Now, that was a beautiful snake. All these patterns and so on. Or you go outside. Do you like a gray day, overcast? You might, because it might take away from you the distraction of the sky and rivet your attention to the glorious colors of the flowers in the garden. So it's helpful to you. But generally, we look at the sky, and if we're looking at the sky by itself, do you want the gray, nondescript day? Or do you want the blue day, blue sky? Or do you prefer the blue sky with puffy clouds that have texture and receive the light in such a way that you've got on the leading edge towards the sun what looks like ribbons of gold, and behind it you've got your grays, and between it you've got pearl and dove? Which do you prefer? You prefer the one that has more texture and more clarity. There's reasons. Now what do we do with human beings? I know a woman, and she is the most ugly person I've ever seen in my life. She was driving in her car. She's from Austria. She came to America. She married an American. A year after her marriage, she was visited by her mother, driving down the freeway. The car is rear-ended by a semi-truck. Her last conscious moment is the car is a ball of flame. When she wakes up in the hospital, she hears that her mother died in the accident. She has lost her left arm. She's lost her left eye. She's lost her face. It's gone. 70 surgeries to give her something that resembles a human face. She is the ugliest person I've ever seen. Did she get bitter as a result of this? No. She responded well. Her character grew in the midst of her adversity. She's on the board of a ministry called Johnny and Friends. Have you ever heard of Johnny Erickson? She's one of Johnny Erickson's best friends. She was in my church when I pastored in Santa Barbara. I have yet to meet a person more saintly and more beautiful than this woman. But her beauty is not by virtue of her face. Her face is ugly. That's objectively true. But her beauty is manifest by something different. Because as human beings, we are not just our outward appearance. And a judgment of beauty cannot be as complete as it can be unless it takes in as much of the complexity as it might. So I'll give you one other example. When I was in college, you have to take this by faith, but I was actually in a 17 magazine, which is a magazine in America, a sort of fashion magazine. I was in a 6-page spread in 17 magazine, 2 pages for each picture, so it was three pages. They were doing a back-to-school issue, and I was an American football player at my college. They filmed this thing at my college, and so the coach needed some football players to show the back-to-school thing. We had to show up. It was in the summer with our football gear, and we were supposed to pose with these models. These were women who were drop-dead gorgeous. They had to do this one shoot, and it was for Nissan, okay? And they were going to have a football player in a car with a model. Now, the three two-page spreads, they took a half a day each to film. One picture gets printed, took a half day. Now, you're a photographer, but, they took thousands of pictures. Now, after that's done, they're going to do this Nissan ad, and they need a football player in this little truck with one of the models, and then in the back of the truck, they were going to put band members and cheerleaders and all this other stuff. So they put this big offensive lineman in the truck, and they said, get him out of there. He makes the truck look too small and too tight. We need a little tiny football player. Jerry, come here. So I get in this truck, and I get to be in this truck for a whole day, half a day, with this model. Okay? I'm a Christian. I go get my Bible. I think she's going to be in the car. I'll just talk to her about Jesus all afternoon. This will be great. Never in my life have I seen such human ugliness as I saw in that model. I worked pipeline construction. I used to be a jackhammerer. I have played football in semi-professional college levels. I've heard men talk, coarse talk, gutter talk. I have never heard such gutter talk as I heard that woman that day. Still to this day in my life, I have never heard and seen such ugliness come out of the mouth of a person and that woman. Drop dead gorgeous physically, but humans are more complex. Okay? So you can see how you can use Lewis and you can apply Lewis in the realm of making objective judgments about beauty. Integrity, proportion, and clarity, that's just a little list. It's not an exhaustive list, but it gets you started in thinking how you might develop this further and further and further as you look at actual objective characteristics in the thing itself, whereby you could say, this is to be pleased over something like this for these reasons, and you can start to come up with further and further objective reasons, because the truths that we know can be plumbed more deeply, applied more widely, and they can be seen in coherent relations.